Her painting life was short, only 8 years, but Emily Carmen-Guare was one of this country's great painters. A blockbuster exhibition of her work was held at the National Gallery in 2024 and a retrospective at the Tate in London in 2025. We spoke at that time to the makers of the documentary Emily, I Am Calm. Producer Anna Grieve and the co-producer and screenwriter, a Luritja and Warramungu woman, Danielle McLean. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
How long have the pair of you wanted to make this film and why?
Good question. I worked at Karma in my 20s and my family actually worked with Emily Nwari. And so I was always really interested in her life and her story. So I could say since I was in my 20s, which is 30 years ago, but the exhibition itself, the National Gallery of Australia's exhibition, really motivated us to go, this is the right time to tell this story. So that was 3 years ago that we started that development.
And why is the story worth telling?
I think she's a really unique woman. She's lived a big life in the bush, and she's such an amazing, strong cultural woman, but that she could bridge those two worlds, you know, going from the bush and then, you know, really make people in the cities fall in love with her and her ideas of country and how she captured that on canvas. You know, I think that's pretty unique.
What about you, Anna?
I just also felt that it was incredible to make a film about a woman who, I mean, she did paint, you know, her life body painting, so and the batiks before she started on the oils. But I just thought it was incredible to show such a powerful woman culturally and in every other way, working within her community, being so grounded community. I think we needed access to that because it's certainly allowed me to see her paintings in a completely different way.
What was the power of the woman? Apart from being this astonishing painter, there is a power in the face, in the way she sits, in the way she walks. What is that power?
I think that's just, you know, being very self-confident and, you know, aware of her place in her society. She was a senior woman. She had a lot of authority around her and she didn't apologise for that. She was a really, you know, she carried those stories and that importance of passing that knowledge on. I think that's in her face, you know, the life she lives in her face, but also the power in her hands and her arms and stuff, the bush life she lived. Also translate into the power she uses in her paintings, how she puts the paint on the canvas.
This woman was, well, long dead before you began to make this film, but the archival footage you found, there she is hunting, there she is cooking. Where is this from?
Yeah, so we were really lucky, actually, and Anna is a great researcher as well as producer, but we had other people that helped us research and find those materials. We worked with people who knew Emily very well and spent a lot of time with her in community. Julia Murray, you know, she was out there working on the ground with Emily, batiking and stuff, and so she recorded stuff that was kind of personal images of friendship and people in community, just living community lives. And I think that's what we really wanted to capture, the not the professional life so much, but who she was as a human being and how she was considered in her own community.
There's a lot of dust in the documentary and Land Cruisers. Did she drive?
The story is that she learnt to drive. She never got her licence. She sounds like she was a very crazy driver.
Yeah. She was very good on the runway, I think.
Yeah, there's a terrifying moment of sort of acceleration madly down a bush track. But she came to painting late, of course. This is the famous fact about Emily. But she had actually painted all her life in one way or another, hadn't she?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, moving to canvas, acrylic paints on canvas is really the story she was telling on in body paint her whole life, you know, that you learn when you're a kid that people are doing that as senior people are doing that to you. You learn to dance, you learn those stories and stuff. And then she was transferring that information onto other women's bodies when they dance ceremony and stuff. So those stories are being told over and over again, just in different mediums.
And there's a wonderful sequence in the documentary where one of the women from Utopia is walking past these pictures saying, emu, yam, seeds. it's you know, this is what's fascinating for a white fella like me, is that those paintings move me profoundly. In fact, I was swearing quite a lot of the time as I was watching the documentary. But I don't know the stories, and yet those pictures have a real punch for me. You don't have to know the story, do you? And yet the story is everything. How is that worked out?
No, I think it's actually about emotional intention and stuff as well, and connection. I think she was putting that energy and that paint on the canvas in a way almost like a ceremony to her country. And somehow that just comes out when you look at those images, you feel that power.
Anna, your thoughts?
She says in the film, and a number of people say, you know, she really believed that if she painted her country, that people would come to understand her country. And so that's sort of central to everything she's doing. I mean, even learning, you know, in paintings that the karma seeds change colour, and that you can see in a painting young women, you know, middle-aged women and older women through the different colour of the seeds. You know, all these things are sort of interconnected and really grounded in the place in which, you know, her family had lived for 65,000 years.
And she had no hesitation telling these stories. There was nothing private about them.
No, I think that's the thing. You know, people know what they're able to share. And if you spend time with women, and if you're, you know, a woman yourself, they will tell you other things, and there's layers of information that get passed. And, you know, we might just learn about a layer that's more like a childlike layer, the first layer. And then you know, as you learn more, as you get older, you learn more story and more detail about being a woman, about these ceremonial stories.
Anna.
Oh, I just think absolutely, you know, the connection, you know, as a white woman, you know, going into that female community, you really feel that if you're in for the long haul, and you know, you develop trust over a period of time, you are given it's a very open sort of offering to you. It's not a closed thing. It's just you know, it's just a connection that they will make over time, and particularly when their first language is not English, so you're also, you know, finding the connection through that.
And I think you're right, though, Anna, like the Ilulgra and Anungra ladies, the Ilulgra being Emily's country and Anungra being the brother country that, you know, shares ceremony. I think those ladies that we worked with were so generous with us and, you know, so willing to share. Obviously, Emily's passed a long time ago, and we really wanted to work with them to check that we're doing the right thing, that they were really happy for her image and her voice and stuff. And they were so generous in that. But I think they know that that's also keeping culture alive, and that this woman, that's her legacy as well, that, you know, this film is her legacy, that she can share that culture with the younger generation.
Oh, yes. But now tell me, how is it that women in the centre of Australia, in the dusty centre of Australia, are working lengths of silk, doing something that seems to be from the culture of Indonesia, batik? How does batik get to Utopia?
Well, I think in the first instance, through Jenny Green coming out there and wanting to do some sort of cross-cultural workshops, and that she brought Julia Murray out, and the two of the women and some other women, including Deborah Speedy, actually introduced batik to the community. And you know, there is a funny scene in the film because, you know, it's a lot of very intensive, labour-intensive work.
Yes.
They had to all use up all their washing powder in the 40-gallon drum to wash the silks and stuff.
But boiling over fires.
Yeah, and now they're hanging, you know, in the National Gallery or in the Tate, you know.
Oh, but first there's a sequence in the documentary where the women are holding these lengths of batik and yes. they're drying in the wind.
Yes.
Yeah, that's just extraordinary.
It is. They're gorgeous, aren't they, too? They're just the way they cap the colour and the movement, and but they're all capturing all those things of the bush life, you know, like Anna said, the food, the ceremonial stuff, the women's awulia, they're all those stories are in their batiks, and then they move into canvas.
This is Late Night Live on Radio National. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Daniel McLean and Anna Grieve about their documentary, Emily, I Am Karma. Now, how was it that Emily was finally sitting in front of sheets of canvas with acrylic paint? And I take it that she had no worries whatever about authenticity or any considerations of that kind. This was a new way of painting. But how come?
So CARMA, so Central Australian Aboriginal Media Association, was asked by ATSIC at the time to take over the running of the Utopia Women's Batik Group. And Rodney Gooch was working for CARMA at the time.
And who was he?
So Rodney was, he was just the manager at CARMA at the time of the Art Centre. And they worked, I think the story goes, they were working with the women with batiks, but batiks cost so much to produce and they are actually quite difficult to make in
and
the bush.
Didn't fetch much money on the market.
No, that's right. And so then there was this idea that they would move to canvas and see what they could. They took out lots of canvases. I think it was something 90 canvases out bush and dropped them off to women across, you know, the Utopia region, so the Sandover region actually, in different various communities and outstations. And then they went back at Christmas time and picked them up. And they got back, I think they, what did they say they got back, Anna?
I think they got back 81 works and I think 79 were by women. And they're the ones that were exhibited as a series that then became the Summer Series, which is a... was at the opening of the National Gallery and it is owned by Holmes of Court, Janet Holmes of Court Collection, who were very generous because in making this film, not financially, but in the sense of they had photographed a lot of the batiks and a lot of the works and they own the entire summer collection. They bought it as one series. So that sort of inspired the whole community to get painting. And
yeah, I think the thing was before that there was obviously the Papunya Chula artists and a lot of them were men. And so this was kind of the first time that women were working on canvas, you know, and as it says in the film, you know, there were certain women that really stood out, you know, the Ada Birds, the, you know, Emily Nguare, you know, those women really stood out amongst that group, not saying that any of the other work wasn't beautiful as well, but they had their own unique styles. And so that's how her kind of career grew because people identified her as a unique artist that could paint and wanted to paint. It sounds like, you know, painting made her happy.
And she went about it with such force. There's such wonderful footage of her slamming the brush down onto the canvas. It's not a dainty business.
No. I think she really owns it, doesn't she?
She does. Yeah. But when did the art market start to pay attention to this name and in the art market known just as Emily?
I think after the Summer Series, it was quite quick that they actually identified her as a solo artist. She started to be in exhibitions and she travelled, her work travelled, she didn't travel, but her work travelled around Australia particularly in those early days. So it didn't take a long time. And one of, you know, her first painting gets chosen to be on the front of the catalogue, you know, Emu Woman. So the very first time she works on canvas, you know, she's identified as this unique artist that's got something to say or something that, you know, as Hetty Perkins says, you know, it draws people to it. So, you know, that energy or that kind of connection between the audience that's looking at the work and the producer is already there. I think that's the thing, she could do that quite early on.
What about you, Anna?
Her trajectory, you know, and coincided with a sort of the growth of an international art market, you know, trajectory in terms of First Nations art. So she sort of was at the foreground and something about her work which just really found a resonance with, you know, the white market. It absolutely did. And, you know, these things within the art market, once things start rolling and she's producing more work, it just, it's commanding higher and higher prices at auctions and it sort of builds. But I think fundamentally there was a connection in her work. It was partly maybe to do with her age when she started on acrylics, but she was freer. She wasn't trying to echo anyone except herself.
Yeah, so. I think there's a real sense of authority to her work and no apologies. This is who I am. This is what I paint.
And there were so many different ways that she painted.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Over her career, she painted quite a few different styles, but they always came back to Alhalgra, you know, like always to country.
Now, you say that she didn't travel, but she did travel. And one of her trips was to Canberra. Why was she going there?
For the Paul Keating Arts Fellowship.
She got a Keating, as we used to say. And here she is describing getting a Keating. When translated, I was there at that place, Canberra, that's me, and that's the one giving me an award. That man, I don't know his name, that was the first time I seen him. Jenny Green, you say his name, Paul Keating. Yes, Paul Keating, he gave me the money from painting. And that was a famous moment because all of that congratulation and real sort of celebration in Australia that Emily had won this fellowship. She declared, didn't she, that she would now give up painting.
That's right. She said she was going to give it up. I think she was tired and thought she would be able to give it up and that, you know, this little bit of money would help her to retire.
But she didn't, did she?
She didn't give up. No. And I think that drive to keep painting and her obligations to the art world, because everyone wanted her art, but also to her family and stuff, she knew she was supporting a lot of people, and that was done in a completely generous way, and her cultural responsibility to those people meant she could, you know, keep painting and provide for lots of people in her community.
Is it clear what she thought of the white world and what she thought of the applause of the white world?
No, I don't think she necessarily needed it, but I actually do think she understood that she was famous. You know, she had that sense of authority and she understood people wanted her work and that by doing this, she was looking after country, not only in the ceremonial sense, but actually bringing stories to the greater white world to understand you need to protect my country. So I think she understood that. She definitely wasn't a stupid woman. She knew about her own worth and the power of her work. So,
but she didn't prioritise, as probably, you know, a white artist might, her own comforts. You know, she still lived in pretty, you know, tough old conditions out there, you know, under a bit of corrugated iron and literally, you know, looking at all the footage, you know, it wasn't just for self-benefit, the painting, it was for the whole community.
Yes, I kept looking in the documentary for her house. I mean, where is her house? And surely with all of this money, there is a house. But the documentary continued to show slabs of corrugated iron. Is that how she lived?
It is. I believe that is how she lived. And then she, you know, as she got older and stuff, she did do stints, I think, in Adelaide and with other family members who may have been selling her art or working with other artists and stuff as well. But she did live a very simple life. I mean, housing in communities is still a huge issue, but there's overcrowding, all those things. But also people want their own space, and those women camps, where women live together without, you know, when they get to a certain age and they haven't got the children and the husbands and stuff like that, they have that sense of community and that there are other women there looking after them and as well. So
yeah, Lily, her friend, you know, she spent many years, you know, with Emily, you know, helping her with the cooking, and, you know, other women in the community would bring her water, cooking, creating fires, bringing food. It was a very older women and younger women seem to really take care of each other.
Yeah, I think that is the obligation to each other, and that family, you're in together, you're around a campfire, that's the place you gather. And, people's lives are very simple in the bush, and sometimes they're very difficult as well. There's no denying that. But there is also this thing that they're together and there's this sense of family and community and everyone, you're not sent off to an old people's home. You're actually still there and people care about you.
You were able to film members of her family and community coming to the National Gallery and seeing last year's exhibition for the first time. What was your sense of that?
Oh, look, I think it was really special and powerful for the ladies. Obviously, at the start of the doco, we sort of make a promise to them, and Kelly Cole and Hetty Perkins say, you'll get to come to the exhibition and you'll get to see it first, when they're saying this is what we want to do. And then they do that, and we're there with them when they see those paintings. And they talk about actually how strong they felt about their culture, but also about her presence, and that they felt that she was there with them. Which I think is really, really beautiful. And as you say, it's a very much like, that's the Yamsi, that's the Woman's Awalia, this is all a Lalagra. They can read the paintings, they walk through the space, this is ours, basically, is what they're saying. They connect to them.
But they were really, it was just fantastic to see how empowered they were by having the paintings, being in there surrounded by the paintings and by everything that had happened. I mean, they were really, it was very emotional for them.
Was it your feeling as well? I know so many people felt this, that they thought they knew Emily's work before that exhibition, but that exhibition revealed so much more and so much that was unexpected.
Absolutely. I think it's a journey, the whole, how much she painted in such a short period of time, and to watch how her style is constantly evolving, in each room until you get to sort of, the giant Yam painting, which is owned by the National Gallery of Victoria, such an epic painting that we've watched her paint on the ground, sitting in the centre of the canvas on a big ground. It was overwhelming, and it was a great privilege we had, because we could spend so long staring at paintings inside that exhibition space while we're doing interviews, so that we could really absorb them. And just the colour and the richness of them was, it just really stays with you.
Is it the same exhibition that's about to open in the Tate?
It is based on the exhibition that Kelly Cole and Hetty Perkins curated. Kelly is actually the curator of the Tate exhibition, and it's based on that. But because these paintings, obviously have to travel so far to get to the UK, so what they've done is picked up different paintings that they couldn't get for the Australian exhibition. So it's based off it, but there'll be other pieces that we didn't see here, and they won't see some of the pieces that we had in this, our local exhibition.
Worth a journey, as they used to say in the guidebooks.
I think so. I'd love to be there.
Yeah.
Now, I take it, Daniel and Anna, you're both collectors of Emily's work. Why are you laughing?
We're documentary filmmakers. I mean, Danielle was very lucky to have a work very, early on from a long time ago. But I think, the life of a documentary filmmaker doesn't stretch to the I have to say I have a cushion cover from the National Gallery.
Excellent. It's a start. Danielle and Anna, thank you so much for joining me on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Danielle McLean, screenwriter, director and co-producer of the documentary, and Anna Grieve, the producer. This is Late Night Live.